Welcome to this month's look at the cancer headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Bill Nelson, director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins.
Bill, I'd like to start this month with the new drug for melanoma. Melanoma, of course, a big killer. Some excitement out there about the potential for new therapy.
This is one of the things that is really exciting within the last year. This is an antibody drug called ipilimumab. That's a mouthful. I think it's going to be marketed under the brand name Yervoy. What ipilimumab does is it does not target the melanoma cancer cells. Instead, it targets the body's defense systems and helps the immune system attack the melanoma cells to eliminate them.
What a cool thing. Of course, we know since it ends in MAB, that means monoclonal antibodies. So tell me a little more about this particular drug.
Yeah, the ipilimumab is exactly that. It's a monoclonal antibody. What it does is it seeks out cells from the immune system and keeps them from being tolerized by the cancer. Tolerized means rendered inactive, pacified in many ways, so they don't respond to the cancer and don't try and kill it. By seeking out those cells and reversing that state, these cells are then brought into play and can attack the cancer, kill cancer cells, and the results of the clinical trial are quite spectacular. About 20% of folks had a very significant benefit. Alive 2 years with metastatic melanoma. That's melanoma that is spread and advancing throughout the body. The price for this, though, is that because you've rendered these tolerized immune cells more activated, they can cause some autoimmune diseases like inflammation of the colon called colitis, for instance. And these can be severe enough to be life-threatening. About 12 or 13% of people in the trial had a significant autoimmune reaction that needed to be treated.
Very concerning, of course. Would you suggest that, though, based on this strategy, we might be developing more drugs of this type that would use this mechanism but may not have that whole constellation of side effects?
So you're exactly right. This is the first of what appear to be a whole collection of these types of treatments, many of them going to be monoclonal antibodies targeting other aspects of how these cells are pacified, if you will. I think as we go forward, we'll have a choice of these. Some of them may be less prone to create autoimmune reactions. I think the key to these autoimmune reactions is that they are recognized and treated aggressively. That appears to be the lesson so far.
Let's go from here to a recent issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, from a new drug to an old drug, or I'll call it an old strategy, hormone replacement therapy for women and cancer risk.
There had been a very large study called the Women's Health Initiative, which tested the effects of hormone replacement. What they learned very quickly is that estrogen and progesterone increase the risk of things like breast cancer. The effects of estrogens alone had a number of different actions on different health threats for women in the postmenopausal age. The trial was restricted to women who had had a hysterectomy because supplementing estrogens is known to increase the risk of tumors, if you will, of the uterus, so-called endometrium cancer. What they found was that there was an increased risk of cardiovascular complications, of stroke, of blood clots, pulmonary emboli, and the like, but a slightly decreased risk of breast cancer. What the study reported most recently was a follow-up of these women. They had taken the drug for 5 to 7 years. They then looked at what happened after the women had stopped taking the drug. Did these increased and decreased risks of health problems persist? And what happened was as women stopped taking the drug after a couple of years, the increased risk of the cardiovascular complications and these other problems diminished, but surprisingly, perhaps, the reduced risk of breast cancer persisted. Maybe a reasonable approach, and we'll see how this settles out, is that young women who've had a hysterectomy who pursue estrogen replacement may be reducing their breast cancer risk somewhat. And if they are carefully picked, there might be a role for estrogen replacement in that group.
Sounds like a really narrow group in whom this particular strategy might be employed.
I think that this is very complicated. I think that these kinds of treatments will need to be individualized, and it will be a moving target. We will learn more and more about the risks and benefits and who is most likely to suffer the risk or enjoy the benefits over time. So keep watching this story.
Speaking of keep watching, you've brought us very nicely to a perspective in a recent issue of the New England Journal of Medicine about vitamin D, the latest darling for everyone, but not looking too good as far as cancer prevention.
So this is a story based on an Institute of Medicine evaluation of the evidence for vitamin D supplementation broadly for health concerns. And of course, what the Institute of Medicine concluded was that there were benefits to having adequate vitamin D levels in the body, particularly for bone health. But there are a whole bunch of population-based studies that correlated low vitamin D levels with high risk for a number of different diseases, heart disease, cancer, obesity. Unfortunately, there have been very few studies where people have been given vitamin D or placebo to see whether supplementation with vitamin D would be really helpful in this. Basically, the conclusion of this group is when you look at very large collections of these studies, there does not seem to be much of a benefit to supplementing vitamin D for the purpose of reducing breast cancer and other types of diseases.
Well, gosh, this seems so disappointing. We all keep looking for the Holy Grail as far as vitamins are concerned, and it sure looked like D was going to be it.
Well, I wonder, actually, if you begin to think about what types of things may have led to a correlation, is people have higher vitamin D levels, tend to be more active, pursue more exercise outdoors, eat a broader and more complete diet. And I wonder if it isn't telling us that a healthy lifestyle is a healthy lifestyle, and that perhaps we can't get everything out of a bottle, that we need to change our behavior, perhaps, to a more healthy behavior.
Excellent. Finally, let's turn this month to a study of yours, and that is the use of a drug called digoxin, and it's a heart drug. It's been around forever, and its potential in prostate cancer.
This was a very interesting thing that we took on. We worked with someone who had collected most of the approved drugs for use anywhere in the world and screened these drugs against prostate cancer cell lines that were available. And we figured out which of these drugs seemed to stop the growth or kill prostate cancer cells. Many of them were drugs that we knew, chemotherapy drugs that are used to treat the disease, loom large in that screen. We did find a number of drugs that surprised us, and one of them was a drug called digoxin. It's been around for a very long time, from the foxglove plant. It's been used more recently to treat heart failure and heart arrhythmias. It surprises us that it tended to treat cancer as well as it did. And so what we did was we went to a visit with an epidemiology friend of ours, Elizabeth Platts. And we asked Elizabeth, were there enough people in the population or in populations that could be studied who had taken the drug digoxin that we could ask on a population scale whether there seemed to be any benefit to taking digoxin on the risk of prostate cancer? And what she discovered was that men who had taken digoxin had a lower chance of developing prostate cancer. I think what this is going to do is lead us to think about what digoxin exactly is doing to prostate cancer cells. And if it's something that we can tease apart or learn about at the detailed molecular level, perhaps this is an avenue to some new treatments for the disease.
Would you call digoxin, though, one of those drugs that no man would want to take it unless he had a good reason for taking it, and that taking it for prostate cancer reduction risk or risk reduction is probably not a great strategy at this point?
Well, this is not something that I would advise anyone go out and do and take. Before anyone would take digoxin for the purpose of prostate cancer, we would need to study it in a very careful way in a clinical trial that assessed the risks and the benefits.
But right now it's back to the lab to see how it works.
Right now it's back to the laboratory to see how it works. There have been some reports a number of years ago that related drugs were able to thwart the effect of activated cancer genes, and that's the real lead at the moment.
Excellent. So that's a look at this month's cancer headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Bill Nelson, and I do believe in a cure for cancer.